Welcome to City Valley Church. Our vision is to be a family, loving Jesus, growing together and reaching Yorkshire and the nations. We hope you are encouraged and hear Jesus speak to you as you listen to this recording.
On the person of Jesus and who he is and what he's done for us. And through this series we've been seeing one message repeated week by week. And that message is Jesus is better. Is better than anything we could achieve, anything we could earn or perform our way into, and better than anything that has gone before. And the author of Hebrews, as he brings his letter to a close, we get to land on what that can actually look like in our everyday lives. The author of Hebrews has painted an incredible picture of who Jesus is, what he's done for us, and that is as relevant and transformative today as it was when it was first written. But before we go any further, I want you to turn to the people around you and just share with each other the best piece of advice that you have ever received. So you've got a couple of minutes. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received? So lots of advice, I'm sure, has been shared. We've got the roving mic. I'd love us to share some of that advice that we've received. So if Becky, you could take the mic around and see what piece of advice we have got.
I can start. The best piece of advice I ever received was the only piece of advice my mum ever gave me, which was, she said this while ironing, she said, never iron for your husband because you'll never stop. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to iron. And I haven't. I have stuck by it. Dave is a lucky man. anybody else? Best advice you've ever got?
Well, I think I've heard this third or fourth hand on a YouTube clip or something, but it's okay to let your kids be bored because they will entertain themselves. Yeah, they are imaginative, they are creative. You don't need to have a regimented plan for every single half an hour every day. And that has been helpful.
Yeah.
So now I don't do anything.
Yeah. I know it feels similar. We just let off the hook from all our chores and duties.
It's okay to say no.
That's an important one. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, good boundaries. Yeah. Anybody else?
I don't know if anyone remembers the song Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen. There's a lot of advice in there that I was like, oh yeah, that sounds like it's good. One of them is, be kind to your knees, you'll miss them when they're gone.
Oh wow. Yeah. That sounds like a very useful song, Joy. Yeah. Great, I'll hand this back to you.
Thank you. So I've actually got three more pieces of advice to give you. The first one is, if you ever see someone crying, don't ask if it's because of their haircut. The second one is, always give 100% unless you're giving blood. And the last one is, it doesn't matter how nice the hand soap smells, never walk out of the bathroom smelling your fingers. As good as those pieces of advice are, and they are genuinely very helpful, I would argue that the best piece of advice that I've ever been given was by Jill, my wife, back in August 2003. At the time, we were engaged to be married, and I remember the moment with incredible clarity. There was genuine concern in her voice as she leaned in, squeezed my hand, and told me, Johnny, don't forget to breathe. See, at the time, I was recovering from some fairly major surgery, and I was actually on the intensive care unit at the Leeds General Infirmary. How I got there and what happened after that is a much longer story, but the following is a brief snippet of that story. When I woke up from the operation, it was clear things had not gone particularly well. I was expecting to be in a bit of pain, but I wasn't expecting a tube to be down my throat breathing for me. And as my condition improved over the following 24 hours, the doctors decided that the tube could come out, which is obviously a good thing. However, once the tube was out, I needed to remember to breathe again for myself. And as I was on a lot of morphine, because I was in a lot of pain, and I was high as a kite, the moment the jaw reminded me to breathe was the point at which I had exhaled, but had forgotten to inhale. So I was lying there, awake, but not breathing. I'm guessing eventually I would have remembered to breathe back in again. But that doesn't take away from the quality of that piece of advice that Jill gave me. We'll come back to that as we go through this talk. But now we're going to dig into the passages we're going to explore today in Hebrews. So we're going to read through the passage in Hebrews 12. It's up on the screen behind me, but I'll read it out as well. So it says, "You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, 'I am trembling with fear.' But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel." So that's pretty clear. I love the way that the writer of Hebrews just assumes that we know what he's banging on about. But to be fair, he was writing to an audience who were likely steeped in the Hebrew scriptures, much more than we are. And they would have known exactly what he was talking about. It's a bit like when we hear a quote from a famous movie. We're transported back into that story in that moment, and there's an image that forms in our mind. So if I was to say to you, life is like a box of chocolates, we might be thinking of a man in a white suit sat on a park bench. Or if I was to say, to infinity and beyond, there'd be an image of a guy in a spacesuit. And if I was to say, you shall not pass, we might think of a guy with an incredible beard talking to a fiery demon. So when the original audience would have heard the first part of this passage, they would have been transported back into the storyline of the Old Testament, just like you were transported back into those famous films with the quotes. It's most likely that they would have been thinking about the story that's being outlined in Exodus 19. And the story that they would have had in their minds would have been about the Israelites' escape from slavery in Egypt. They would have been picturing how the Israelites were led miraculously through the Red Sea. They would have been seeing how the chasing army was thwarted by God, and the way that the Israelites quickly turned from gratitude to being hangry, and then God providing food for them in the form of manna from heaven, and how God provided water from a rock, and how he protected them from attack. And then they would have been thinking about how when the Israelites were called to approach the mountain to meet the Lord, how intimidating and fearful they would have been. In Exodus 19, it tells us what the presence of God looked like on Mount Sinai. It said, "On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning, with a thick cloud was over the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently." So this mountain is covered in thick cloud, on fire and trembling violently. Everyone in the camp was petrified. They were being invited by God up to the mountain, but they were too scared to go. They were so scared that they refused God's invitation and asked Moses to go and be their mediator. And this is what it's like to approach God without a mediator. His presence is so holy and intimidating, you are likely going to be holding your breath and forgetting to breathe. We have a wonderful black Labrador who is part of the joy and pain of our life. But as we approach November, she just doesn't cope with the fireworks that are going off. She sits there trembling and hiding away, and she's panting, unable to eat even a favourite treat, which, if you know our dog, is pretty amazing. But she can't even entertain going outside if she needs the loo. She just sits there and shakes, and it's heartbreaking to watch. It's really difficult, and we just have to sit with her and comfort her. But the whole Israelite camp were trembling with fear and the intimidation of seeing a holy God descending on the mountain before them was just too much for them. But the author of Hebrews reminds us that this is not the mountain that we come to. He says, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire. He starts off by saying, this is not where we're going. The author is telling us, and the readers, that something has changed, that there's a new mountain for us to consider, and that is the mountain of Zion. He says, but you have come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. This is a completely different mountain. The same presence, but something is different. It's talking about a city, not a wilderness. It's talking about a joyful assembly, not trembling. There are thousands of angels celebrating. The church of the firstborn, people whose names are written in heaven, are there. And at the center is Jesus, the mediator of this new covenant, and the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word. The author of Hebrews tells us that this is the mountain that we now come to. That you are welcomed here, not because you've earned it, not because you've sorted yourself out, but because Jesus is standing there as your mediator and priest, presenting you to the Father, not because of anything you have done, but because of what he has done for you. In Luke 15, Jesus tells a story that puts flesh on this in a way that is hard to forget. He tells a story of a family that is broken apart, a father with two sons, neither of whom really know him. The younger son asks for his inheritance, and the father willingly gives it to him, and he leaves and goes and blows it all on parties and promiscuity. And when it inevitably all goes wrong, the young son is broken and ashamed, and he decides to return home, not knowing what to expect, but hoping that his father might accept him as a slave. He rehearses a speech as he returns home. He says, Father, I have sinned against heaven and I have sinned against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. He is approaching the Father as if he is a blazing mountain, like the mountain of Sinai, willing to risk it all by presenting himself in front of the Father, but wanting to earn his way back in. I imagine he was walking home in fear and trembling, holding his breath, preparing to earn his way back in, expecting Sinai, expecting thunder and lightning, and possibly even death. But what he received was entirely different. It was much more like he was approaching Zion. The father saw him, and while he was still a long way off, he ran and embraced him, welcoming him in. Before the speech that the son had been rehearsing was even finished, a robe was on his shoulders, a ring was on his finger, sandals were on his feet, and a welcome home feast had begun. His identity was fully restored before a single thing had changed in his life. And I wonder if the first thing the son did when those arms went around him was feel permission to breathe again. Likely he was holding his breath the whole way home, and his father's embrace said, "It's okay. Don't forget to breathe." And then once the welcome home party was in full swing, the other brother was found standing outside, furious, refusing to go in. He was indignant because he had behaved and had given years of faithful service. But listen to what he says. He says to his father, "I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders." He was slaving. That's the language of a God who expects us to behave before we belong. A God who is like the God on Sinai. He was following the rules, but he had not received a sense of belonging. His anger at the party reveals that he'd been thinking of his father all these years as if he was a father who keeps accounts, who expects good behavior before you're allowed in. This son was also living with the father every day, but never accepting the embrace. He was working hard to earn his father's love, but not ever really breathing. And we face the same question. Which mountain are you coming to when you think of God? Both are in the Bible. Both describe his presence. But they describe two fundamentally different experiences of approaching him. When you really think about it, do you come to God holding your breath? Either looking at yourself and saying, "I'm not worthy. I'm not accepted. Look at my life, it's a mess. What God would want me to be here?" Or do you approach it by saying, "I've done so many good things this week. I've worked hard, I've done and said the right things. I've earned the right to be here." But again, hoping that God will accept you. Through Jesus, we should not be approaching God as if we're standing at the foot of Mount Sinai. The author of Hebrews is telling us that we are invited to come to the mountain of Zion, a presence that is calling you in because you are forgiven. It's no less holy or intimidating. The thing that makes it different is that Jesus is there, presenting you to the Father, not on the basis of your track record, but on the basis of his life, his death, his resurrection and his ascension. And Zion is the place where God himself leans in, the way that Jill leaned into me and says, "Don't forget to breathe." So what does a person look like who has remembered to breathe? Some of us might not have remembered what it feels like to breathe in the presence of God. Some of us might have never actually encountered what it's like to be accepted, to realize that we're invited in to breathe in the presence of God. Just like I was there, lying on my back in that hospital bed. I'd forgotten what it felt like to breathe. I had to learn again. I had to remember and get that muscle memory going, allowing my body to naturally do what it is it needed to do. And that's what it's like being in the presence of God. Our identity is shaped by this. Just earlier we were talking about how we're made in the image of God. When we're made in the image of God, we behave not because we need to behave, but because of who we are as individuals. And often we don't even realise that we're not breathing in the presence of God because we've realised it's just hard work. The natural state, the way that we're designed to, live, is what we're going to talk about in chapter 13. When you realise who you are first, that you are accepted and you are loved, you don't need to remember to breathe. It becomes second nature. You're no longer holding your breath before God, no longer performing for acceptance. Something has changed. Not just in how you think about and experience God, but in how you see the people around you. When we look at chapter 13, the author of Hebrews is painting a picture of what that looks like in ordinary daily life. This isn't a list of rules or expectations, and it's definitely not a tick box of things that we need to do to be accepted, because we are accepted. But this is when we're breathing, when we're truly in God's presence, these are the natural behaviours that flow out of us. The author says to keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. He purposefully uses the language of family, brothers and sisters, but this isn't necessarily about biological family. It's about the people around us, our friends, our community, those we love and trust. You don't love these people because they've earned it or because they get it right all the time. You love them because of who they are to you. But when you yourself realize and recognize that you have been welcomed into God's family, not on the basis of your performance, but on the basis of who Jesus is, this should change the way we see other people. We'll stop keeping records of wrongdoing. You stop waiting for people to earn your acceptance. You love the way that you have been loved, freely, before deserving it. The younger son needed to receive the love of his father before he'd changed anything. And that's the love that we're called to extend to one another, as challenging as that might be. In verse 2, in chapter 13, the author invites us to show hospitality to strangers. The Greek word that is translated as hospitality is philonexia. It's two words joined together, philos, meaning friend, and xenos, meaning stranger, foreigner, or guest. So it literally means to be friends to strangers, foreigners, and guests. Not because this is a nice thing to do, but because you know what it's like to be a stranger who was welcomed in. You were outside looking up at Mount Sinai, and now through Jesus, God welcomes you in. Hospitality in this context isn't a dinner party for people you already know and like, although that doesn't mean we shouldn't do that. It's about your posture of openness to people who have nowhere else to go. Who's on the outside in your world? Who hasn't been welcomed? Someone who knows that they are welcomed by grace finds it easy to extend that welcome to others. That's what breathing looks like in the presence of God. In verse 3, we're reminded to remember those in prison as if you were with them, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. This isn't just to remember people who are suffering, it's to remember them as if you were there with them. This is only possible when you know you yourself were once bound by guilt and shame, or by a performative behaviour. You don't stand at a distance and offer sympathy, you stand alongside and enter into their story. In verse 5, the author says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Contentment isn't about having so much stuff you don't need anything else, because, let's be honest, that's never going to happen. But it's about being grounded in your identity. It's not about the Father restoring your place in the family. It's about you recognizing that through Jesus that you are enough. Last January, 2025, we had a prophetic word about our church that we are enough. This isn't just a nice soundbite, but it's the heart of who we are. It's the heart of our identity. These four things are just there to paint a picture. And please hear me right, I have a lot of work to do here. We need to remember that this is not a checklist of behaviours, that when we do them, we are behaving correctly and therefore accepted. They're not a set of rules to follow in the hope that God will be pleased with us. But this is what a community looks like when we're living in our true identity, when a sense of belonging and identity have come before our behaviour. So as I finish, we're going to look back into Hebrews 12 in verses 28 to 29. It says, "Therefore we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire." The author of Hebrews has invited us to remember that we do not stand at Sinai where feelings of not being worthy or that you have to do the right thing to be accepted drive our identity, but where you're holding your breath, wondering if you are enough. We need to realize that we approach God on Mount Zion, where Jesus is standing before the Holy God saying, "Because of me, they are enough." And when we arrive in his presence, there is a consuming fire. He is still a holy God. But his fire isn't there to destroy us. It's there to transform us. It's there to burn away our shame, our need for performance, and any fear that keeps us holding our breath. It refines us and restores us to our true identity. And once we've encountered that fire, once we've been loved and accepted by the Father, we're actually free to do what chapter 13 describes. To love one another freely, to show hospitality to strangers, to stand alongside those in pain, and to live without the anxiety of needing to prove ourselves. The consuming fire changes us so that we can love like we've been loved. So as I finish, I want to share that piece of advice that Jill gave me when I was on the intensive care unit at the LGI, as Jill leaned in and squeezed my hand and said, "Johnny, don't forget to breathe." That's the message that I believe we need to hear this morning. And it's not me that's saying this to us. It's God our Father. When we approach him, he throws his arms around us and reminds us to breathe. So I want to ask us today, how do you approach the presence of God? Do you come feeling unworthy? Approaching the throne with a sense of dread, hoping that somehow you'll be accepted, that you'll be loved, or maybe that you're even worthy enough? Or do you come thinking that, "I've done a good job this week, I've done a Bible reading, I've been kind and compassionate, I've ticked all the boxes. Surely God will accept me for what I've achieved this week." Both of those are us approaching God as if he is the God of Sinai. Both of those are us holding our breath. And we're not called to do that. We're called to recognize that regardless of who we are, what we've done, or what we've achieved, or what you haven't achieved, where you've fallen short, where you feel like you've excelled, none of that matters. Because the opening gambit from the Father is he throws his arms around us and lavishes his love on us. This is the act that says you are loved before you do anything. You belong before you behave. Your identity is given not by what you have done, but by what Jesus has done. We're fully restored, not by a wishy-washy hope, but by an unshakable King who is sat on the throne. We're going to close with a time of worship. And that's the best place to start, because as we breathe in, the breath that we breathe out starts with worship. It starts with thankfulness to a God who has welcomed us in. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We pray you have been blessed by this talk today. If you would like to know more about our church, where we meet, or would like to speak with someone from City Valley, please visit our website at cityvalley.org.